This is the Yara Crop Nutrition Podcast. Yara is the global leader in crop nutrition knowledge and the leading producer of quality fertilizer products. The podcast is intended to facilitate the transfer of knowledge for farmers and crop advisors, improving farm profitability and environmental sustainability. With Yara, knowledge grows.
It's Tuesday once again, where we share some bite-sized agronomic tips. Our goal is to share some knowledge that will help you, the farmer and advisor, grow your profits in a sustainable way. This week, we continue our discussion on corn agronomics. Dr. Steve Peachy, our Director of Agronomic Services, joins me to make sure the right questions are asked, and with our guest, David Chafin, a Yara digital agronomist. Today, we're going to take a deeper dive into some of the latest practices and golden nuggets that can help growers improve yields and quality in a sustainable and profitable way. Tell me, David, in the last, let's say, 10, 15 years, what have been the biggest advancements in corn production?
I think 10, 15 years, I would say, you know, genetics for sure. And probably then also the trait packages, the genetically modified trait packages of.
What does that mean?
Genetically modified would be your GMOs. It'd be like a trait like Roundup Ready, you know, Roundup Ready corn or rootworm resistant corn or European corn borer. So, I mean, it's that genetically modified to fight those pests without having to use a pesticide or a particular type of herbicide to control weeds or pests or diseases. So, I mean, that's probably the biggest one. That can be traced all the way back to whenever they discovered hybrid corn, which was back in the 40s. I mean, I think that was the next leap was the genetically modified traits.
I'm gonna jump in here and throw my Michigan State Spartan hat on for a second. I did my BS degree there. And actually the first work with hybrids was done by Dr. Beal. And I'm going to say the 1870s or 80s.
Oh, wow.
I'm not sure. But he was the first to grow corn and force it to self-pollinate.
Okay.
Cycle after cycle after cycle. And, of course, each crop was successively shorter and more stunted and didn't do as well. And then when he crossed those inbred lines is when Heterostis Hybrid Vigor. He was the first, as far as I understand it, to observe that phenomenon called heterosis and where we call it hybrid vigor in English. And that became the basis for hybrid corn. And the first hybrid corns were, help me out here, but probably the late 30s were when they were first released, but they were, you know, you couldn't save your own seed. And so there was resistance from the farm community because they could no longer shows the best ear and save those. They had to buy seed every year from somebody else, and so the economics changed and so forth. And that's a whole nother subject, but I have to put on my Michigan State hat because of Dr. Beal and so forth
there. Yep. So that would have been single cross hybrids,
right? Yeah.
And so later they came out with double cross hybrids. So I'm going to one up you, and I'm going to say Henry Wallace here from Iowa in Johnston, Iowa, came up with the double cross, which is what we are using today. But
well, let's get in some gold nuggets. Here we are in 2020. What are some of the things that you, as you visit farmers and see what they're doing, what are some of the biggest ahas or golden nuggets that you think that if a farmer did this, they can really increase that genetic potential?
For me, it's been the nitrogen management piece. That's the whole reason I'm at Yara. As I learn about adaptive nitrogen management, it's because nitrogen's so dynamic, right? It, you know, it's so influenced by so many factors like weather and soil texture and organic matter levels. So much of our management today is static. So even if you think of the four R's, and trying to pick the right rate at the right time with the right source. That might change every year. So I think we need to take nitrogen management to the next step of factoring in that the right rate, the right source, the right timing, all of that might be different every single year. And it's based on the fact that these models can now help us figure out what that rate should be. I've had some experiences where, you know, when we start to use a model in our nitrogen management, I mean, I was getting some of the farmers I worked with, you know, their nitrogen efficiency in some years down to 0.6 pounds of nitrogen per bushel of corn. And we were raising 250 bushel corn. Wow. And so to me, that's the biggest gold nugget right now. We just need more producers and more agronomists learning about how to do more adaptive nitrogen management. You know, some years you may grow 250 bushel corn with 100 pounds of nitrogen, and some years you might grow 250 bushel corn with 200 pounds of nitrogen. It's going to depend on the year and depend on the weather that is affecting that hybrid and the nitrogen specifically. You know, did we lose it? Did we leach it? You know, did we have a year where it rained just right and mineralization was perfect and our loss was low? You know, or are we having a year where it's just extremely dry and, you know, it doesn't matter if we put 100 pounds or 200 pounds out, we're only going to get 150 bushel corn because it's just so darn dry. That to me is the biggest nugget, is really honing in our nitrogen management skills. Because like I said, it and weather are, 53% of yield, right? So if we can get those two things right, we're doing some good things.
So Dave, let me look at this from a different angle. You know, you mentioned you could grow 250 bushel corn with different amounts of nitrogen. That 250 bushel corn crop has probably taken up about the same amount of nitrogen, regardless of what we put on. So, yep. So that tells me that we have the potential not only to be more efficient and save growers money on the nitrogen input, but we have opportunity to improve the environment as well. Correct. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. So it's all about, the four R's, right? Improving that right rate, right time, right source. To get that efficiency. And that might mean one year we're putting all the nitrogen on up front, and some years it might be splitting it out into two, maybe even three applications. But it's being able to monitor when the crop needs it and getting it out there. But also to your environmental point, you know, some years certain soils, especially higher organic matter soils, have the ability to mineralize quite a bit of nitrogen on their own. So we need to feed that process. So I think one of the misconceptions is farmers think, well, I put on 200 pounds of nitrogen and that grows me the 250 bushel corn. Well, in reality, 100, maybe 50 pounds of that actually starts the microbial process and feeds that microbial process to start the mineralization. And so it's really not the 50 pounds of nitrogen we applied that feeds the crop. It's the mineralized nitrogen later on in the season that actually feeds the crop. So, but you're right. When we really fine tune how we manage the nitrogen, it's going to have a huge effect on the environment. We're going to really cut back on the amount of loss that goes into, things like the hypoxia zone in the Gulf of Mexico. Those are the kind of things that, not every farmer thinks about, but he also understands that also saves him money. It also puts money in his pocket. So even if the environmental impact is not first and foremost on his mind, there's other reasons to do that are on his mind, like paying for college for his kids and by saving nitrogen that he doesn't have to buy.
David, I'm sitting here and putting myself in my farming boots and saying, okay, I want to be a good corn farmer. and all these variables. I'm going to call them arrows of variability. Did you catch that, Steve? Arrows of variability. I'm painting a picture of metaphor here. And all these arrows of variability are coming at me at different times, and they're just bombarding me. Where do I start to become just a little bit better?
I think the area that we still need to grow on is really providing some easy to use tools that helps a farmer really understand the true variability in his field. Because we're at a point to where we have tools that we can manage that if we can understand it. So if we can understand it, we can actually make corrective actions in our plan. You know, in some areas, there's parts of that field that it's never going to grow more than 150 bushels of corn. But if there's other parts of that field that are capable of probably 300 bushel corn, and we're only feeding it for 250 because we're using that as our whole field average. So just understanding the variability exists, what that variability is, and then how can we manage it better? Is it lower seed population? Is it higher seed population? Is it more nitrogen, less P and K? Maybe even taking some of those acres out of production and putting them into a conservation reserve program because they're just never going to be profitable.
David, you mentioned P and K right there, and that prompts me to ask a question. And you know, I grew up in Michigan, but I moved out west when I started graduate school, and I've been out west my whole career, and so don't deal much with corn. But I have read a little bit about it and talked with some folks, and at these really high yield levels, the 300 to 400 bushels in these yield contests and so forth. One thing I pick up from folks is that the standard soil test recommendations probably aren't appropriate at those types of levels. And some of the folks I've talked to do something that, you know, would be an anathema to some folks, and that is they just use a shotgun application, quote unquote, of micronutrients with, you know, copper, boron, manganese, zinc, and iron. Irrespective of soil tests, they'll use that typically as a soil-based material, but it could be some foliar. Same thing with phosphorus and potassium, that obviously they worry about the environment with the phosphorus, but they place it such that it's not going to be lost. That they tell me that at those levels of productivity, we're off the curve in terms of our soil test. What's been your experience when you deal with those really remarkable levels?
I would agree with you. I mean, the average farmer probably does not pay nearly enough attention to those things, right? It's been even recently that our average farmers or the majority of farmers in the Midwest, not the ones going for the extremely high yields. It's just been recently that we've added micronutrient tests to our soil testing, and then also incorporating that into, you know, things like grid sampling on a subfield level to really define the variability of those micronutrients. And even things like tissue testing, you know, in season, that's relatively small and relatively new yet in the Corn Belt. We've always taken for granted that we have this black, rich soil that can, you know, we throw the seed on the ground and it grows 250 bushels. And that's not the case. I think those high yield guys are proving exactly what you're saying, that we need to do a better job of both tracking those, all the nutrients, and that, you know, things like sulfur and zinc and boron are just as important, maybe not at the same levels as N, P, and K, but just as important to achieving those top yields as, you know, nitrogen is. Yeah, I think you're spot on. And to me, I like to take it even farther is really diving into those things at the subfield level, because there is probably still areas of that field that are adequately or above adequately supplying those nutrients naturally, but then there's other parts of the field that aren't. You know, they're the poorer parts of the field, and maybe boron and sulfur and zinc could help those areas. You know, I think about, you know, sandy soils, you know, they tend to be lower in those micronutrients. And so we've always just treated them as sandy soils, but could we actually do something to at least get them up to maybe not, 300 bushels, but can we get them from 150 to, 200 on a consistent basis if we manage those micronutrients even better?
Well, one of the things that I talk about with folks when I'm talking about soil testing, if we've taken a field average, we've taken a standard sample of the field and make a uniform fertilizer recommendation, is that just by what an average is mathematically, half the field is above that and half the field is below that.
Right.
And it's probably a weighted average because it's not uniformly distributed. And so if the soil test is near the critical level, whatever that is, whatever the nutrient is, phosphorus or potassium or zinc, if the critical level is, say it's zinc, it's point, I don't know in your area, 0.6 parts per million zinc, yep, is probably the critical level that's,
yep,
commonly used.
Yep.
Okay, if your soil test comes back at 0.7 or 0.8, I can almost guarantee there's deficient areas within the field just by what the nature of average means.
Yep, you're exactly right. Yep.
And so if you do that then for phosphorus or potassium, now, I don't recommend that people over-fertilize to solve that problem, but that's where we get into what you talked about, which was managing within the variability that we know is out there.
Exactly. Yep.
David, you mentioned that the first step is really to understand what you have, that there are some areas of your field that aren't capable of doing what we want to do, and the other areas are. How do you figure that out? Is that by going and doing just a ton of soil sampling, grid sampling through the field?
There's a bunch of different ways to look at field variability. Yield data, especially if it's mapped, geo-referenced yield data. I mean, that can give us a pretty good indication of different things going on in that field. Either grid or zone soil samples that can help solve that equation, and even imagery, satellite or flown imagery, can help us define those areas at different times of the field, or even putting multiple years of historical either yield or imagery data together to really, define what those different areas are of the field, if for no other reason for us to go investigate more. A lot of times imagery is just that. We don't know why the imagery is saying what the imagery is saying, but it at least gives us a way to go efficiently dig in deeper, so to speak, to figure out what's going on in that particular area of the field.
And do we have the capability once we understand what we have, do we have the capability to do a precision application of nutrition?
Yeah, I mean, 20 years ago, you'd have to, request or even order specifically that equipment to come on the machinery. Today, I mean, yes, it's a higher price piece of equipment, so you're still paying for it, but it's coming standard. And if you don't want it, you pretty much have to now request to not have it on there. We've come a long way in that equipment side of things. I think one thing that we continually improve on the accuracy of that equipment, if you think about a broadcast fertilizer spreader, it's spreading, they used to spread, 40, 50 feet, and now they're spreading 90 to 120 feet of product out of that machinery. So you still are going to have some overlap. You're still going to have, even with the best equipment, a little bit of lag. So like as you're coming into the end rows or going across the waterway, it's not going to shut off quite right on the line of where you'd want it to shut on and off. Same with sprayers. I mean, John Deere just came out here a couple of years ago with where they can literally now with an accurate GPS boundary of the field, they can control every single nozzle on 120-foot boom sprayer. So you can shut off every single nozzle as you're coming across, at an angle up on a waterway. It will literally just shut off each nozzle as it goes across that waterway. The driver doesn't even have to stop. Just keep right on going. As soon as he gets to the other side, each nozzle just turned right on, right on the dotted line. I mean, that's how accurate it's getting. And, you know, there's even in a future of not so distant future of where, you know, that nozzle is only going to turn on as if it, a sensor senses a weed in front of it. That's how fast this is advancing in the equipment side of things. So yeah, we do have the equipment. I think the biggest thing we're lacking is we have all these tools to define variability, but they're all still in pieces. So like tying imagery in with yield data, in with soil data, in with maybe topography and elevation. And some of those factors are, you know, there still needs to be something that can bring all those systems together, all those layers of data together, to truly build like the super master algorithm that could really tell us exactly how to manage every square inch of that field. I mean, I think that's coming, but I think that's where we got to strive to get to. Like even on my own family farm, I have 10 years of yield data, I have 15 years of grid soil samples. And I still can't, when I write a seeding prescription, a variable rate seeding prescription or a variable rate fertilizer prescription, I can't quite get down to the true variability of the field that I know is there, not without a ton and ton of effort. And even at some points, I can't even get it even with tons of effort. So we got to make improvements on really bringing all those layers of data together to really get down to the true managing that field as accurately as we possibly can. I think that's the one thing holding us back on, you know, people are talking about, you know, building algorithms to be able to predict yield, like as early as, you know, right now, V1, V2 stage of corn, like being able to predict that. And that to me is what's missing, is being able to bring all those layers to get together to actually build out those algorithms that would accurately predict yield now for the end of the season.
We've come a long way on one hand, yes. But yes. On the other hand, we still have an opportunity to improve.
For sure, yeah.
And get to that ideal level of maximizing that genetic capability. Real quick, let's pretend that you bumped into me on the elevator and I had a COVID mask on, so you didn't recognize me. And I said, "Hey, you're wearing an Yara Adapt In hat. What is that?" And I'm only going up 10 floors, so that's all the time you have.
Okay, all right. That's a very good question. So it is a nitrogen model that helps an agronomist and or a grower do a more adaptive nitrogen approach. So it uses the weather, the soils data, his management practices, like, is he using cover crops or no cover crops? Is he, you know, is he putting on his nitrogen in the spring or in the fall or a split application? Takes all that into account, and it will model both the mineralization and the nitrogen loss throughout the season for the different areas of the field to, on any given day during the season, make a updated fertilizer nitrogen recommendation. So we can basically monitor the nitrogen all throughout the season and confidently make a recommendation. Came out of Cornell University by Dr. Harold Van Es. He and a whole slew of researchers, I mean, the research behind it goes all the way back to the 1970s and 1980s. So that's how long they were working on the different components of it. And I call it a model, and it's actually like, I think it's like 13 different models. There's crop growth model, there's, you know, hydrology models, there's all kinds of different models that go into the overall Adapt-In tool.
So what you're telling me is Adapt-In could be equated to a shield that can protect me from these arrows of variability.
More like we can make the arrows hit the target.
Oh, better. You know, that's a much better metaphor. We'll
we can direct those arrows to hit the bullseye.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
This has been a wonderful conversation. I really appreciated the chance to learn from David. Thank you so much.
You bet. I'm very happy to be here and talk to you guys about it.
On the table behind you, David, I think you have a crystal ball. What does the season look like? Is this going to be a big year for corn?
Yeah, because we started off with really good conditions for planting in most of the Midwest. Not so much out east on the East Coast, which is not as big a corn area as the Midwest, of course. But here we started off really, really well. So that's always a good sign that good things are going to come. Back to our beginning of our conversation, we had the sayings of, you know, knee high by the 4th of July. Well, one I remember is plant in the dust and the bins will bust.
Oh.
So we had not dry conditions, but we had really ideal conditions for planting. So that's going to go a long ways.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Thanks, Steve. It's really interesting to get to know a little bit more about corn and some of the agronomic practices that have raised our game and some of the things that we can do to continue to raise our game. If this interests you, you can find out more by going to yara.us or yaracanada.ca. And in that search engine, just put corn. And you'll see articles that range from increasing corn yield to quality, reducing corn cob defects, general corn nutrition, all sorts of good information there. Or go check out and talk to your local retail agronomist.
You've been listening to the Yara Crop Nutrition Podcast. For more information about our company, please visit us at www.yara.com or yara.us, or for Canada, yaracanada.ca.